Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
Nobody has more respect for women than I do. Nobody.
Hillary Clinton wants to abolish it. Believe me. She wants to abolish our Second Amendment.
I think they didn't deny it. I don't think anybody denied it.
Other presidents did not call. They'd write letters, and some presidents didn't do anything.
Many people have come out and said, I'm right.
You really do have to ask yourself, where does it stop?
Hello and welcome to Fallacious Trump, the podcast where we use the insane ramblings of Jaffa Joffrey to explain logical fallacies. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm your other host, Mark. A logical fallacy is an error in reasoning that results in bad or invalid arguments. And the logical fallacy we're looking at this week is the appeal to fiction fallacy.
So regular listeners may be aware that every 11 episodes, I will insert a fallacy that can't usually be found in lists online, because it's one that I've made up slash identified in the wild.
Identified. It's not made it up.
Named, and I like to do that. Yeah. And so episode 88 is coming up, and I've been thinking, well, what the hell am I going to do this time? Because in the past, it's kind of occurred to me as we go along, and I've written it down, and said, oh yeah, we'll do that on one of our 11 episodes. And this time, I identified, I thought, a new fantasy. Yeah. Based on a few things that I'd thought about recently.
And what did you call it?
I called it the appeal to fiction fallacy.
Oh, okay.
In my notes. Yeah. And then I looked that up just to see, in case anyone had called something else completely different by the same name. Right. Turns out, people have written this down before.
They call the same thing the same name.
Including some of the same examples that I'd already thought.
Oh, no, really?
So I didn't come up with this one.
It just goes to show that you're a thought leader in the field.
Yeah.
That's what it is.
Yeah. So, yeah, this isn't in some of the lists that you'll see, because I hadn't heard of it before, but it is, if you look around, you can find it. And the appeal to fiction is when people try to use a fictional situation scenario to give evidence for or back up an argument that they're making about the real world.
Right. Yeah.
And obviously the flaw in that is it's fucking fictional.
it's made up. It doesn't exist. Yeah.
So that isn't a great argument to back up your claims. So our first example from Trump, we haven't actually talked about before, and it's when he made claims like this.
They have unbelievable vehicles. They make a lot of money. They have the best vehicles you can buy. They have stronger, bigger, and faster vehicles than our police have, and then ICE has, and then Border Patrol has. So they're pretty good at that. They have areas that they go to. It's like a highway. And we have to close them up. And if we don't close them up, you're all kidding yourselves. Look, we can all play games, but a wall is a necessity.
So he's talking there about human trafficking, coyotes, as they are sometimes called, who have these amazing vehicles, better, faster than the police, than border protection, than customs.
Yeah.
And so they can, you know, outrun, outdrive all those people. They tie up women in the back seat and put duct tape around their mouths.
Yeah.
And all these kinds of things that he's been talking about. And what we found, what we read about was that someone identified a lot of the things that he was saying about the coyotes didn't actually have anything to do with reality at all, if you talk to anyone who knows anything about human trafficking, especially across the southern border, but did bear a striking resemblance to a film called Sicario 2 Day of the Soldado, which was a sequel to Denis Villeneuve's original Sicario. And the coyotes in that film having like super rocket powered cars and stuff like that. They had there was a scene in there where
blacked out Hummers.
There was a scene where they had the kind of the Muslim terrorists who were coming into the country had left their prayer mats in the desert near the border, and Trump retweeted a tweet about how they'd found prayer mats out in the desert, which no one was ever able to verify, but was definitely from the film.
He lifted from the movie. Wow. So it makes you kind of wonder, well, when he was, you know, sitting in the bedroom in the White House upstairs with all his screens on, whether he couldn't actually tell which was the news and which was fiction.
Yeah.
Because he's got CNN going on.
Yeah, it all blends into one.
Other, and then the movie channel going on the other.
Yeah.
So it all kind of blends in. So he's just going,
I saw this
oh my
thing.
God.
It was incredible. They had really fast cameras.
Yeah. And let's just hope he's never watched District 9 or anything like that. There are aliens and they come in and they're floating over South Africa.
But yeah, these fact patterns that he keeps talking about are not identified by anyone who actually works in that kind of area. In the area of reality. And the Washington Post pointed out that they looked at 570 cars that were impounded by Customs and Border Protection, and they were mostly knackered old saloons about 15 years old with a median value of $2,500. So not super fast. Of course, you could say that is just a kind of survivorship bias thing, and that was only the ones they impounded.
Yeah.
Whereas all the super fast ones, they couldn't catch them. So
yeah.
So that's not, I can't say for certain that there weren't rocket powered cars.
Crossing the border in Mexico.
Be. You never know.
If only he'd watched Men in Black as his reference point, he would just go, aliens smuggling in.
Border Patrol have rocket powered cars. That's what I want to know. If he thinks they've got them, why not soup up their cars? Give them Lamborghinis like the police in Dubai.
Yeah, rather than build a wall,
just
give them faster cars.
Yeah.
Surely, not hard, really. Mm. Get fast enough to overtake them and then throw the stinger in front of them.
Yeah.
Blow the tyres out.
That'll do it.
Yeah. Every time.
So our second example comes from a tweet that he sent on April 14th, 2020. And this was when he was claiming that he had total authority to reopen the country again. Obviously quite early on in COVID, in the lockdowns.
Yeah,
was saying, no, we're going to reopen. And obviously people started pointing out states' rights and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And the governors, especially Democratic governors who were prepared to actually stand up to him rather than the Republican ones, were saying, we're not going to open up our states. That's insane.
Yeah.
And so he tweeted, tell the Democrat governors that Mutiny on the Bounty was one of my all-time favourite movies. A good old-fashioned mutiny every now and then is an exciting and invigorating thing to watch, especially when the mutineers need so much from the captain. Too easy. So he is likening the Democrat governors to the mutineers in Mutiny on the Bounty and him to Captain Bligh.
Yeah.
Which kind of suggests either he hasn't seen Mutiny on the Bounty.
Yes.
Or identifies with Captain Bligh, which is another entirely possibility.
Yeah. It's kind of weird. It's an invigorating thing to watch, especially when the mutineers need so much for the captain. But the Mutiny on the Bounty, don't they succeed?
Yeah. And he's clearly the villain. He's like lists of top villains in cinematic history, Bligh ranks in the top 20.
It's a Godzilla. Exactly. Yes. Quite. So no, he hasn't. He's never watched it. Of course he hasn't.
The point is, even if he'd got it right and the mutiny had been something completely different and Bligh had been the hero, it's still not a good way to back up your position to say, I'm fine. I'm obviously doing the right thing and the Democrats are doing the wrong thing. Because in films, sometimes people mutiny against captains.
Yeah. Because in a book that somebody wrote, in a story about a mutiny, there was a mutiny. And you think, what? So, so we should go, you're right. That's because of your literary prowess and your references to other things that we've all seen. We just go, we know what you mean.
And speaking of books and literary prowess, our third example is from Donald Trump Jr.
Who's got nine of those?
When Trump got suspended from Twitter permanently, finally.
Yeah.
And he said, we are living Orwell's 1984. Free speech no longer exists in America. It died with big tech, and what's left is only there for a chosen few. This is absolute insanity. And 1984 is constantly used by the right to claim that everything is, you know, it's all free speech is ended because private companies are allowed to not amplify your opinions.
Your particular opinions, which are hateful and insurrectional, if that's a word. Yeah.
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 And even if that was what 1984 was about, what it was would about. Be a bad argument.
Yeah.
But it's a particularly bad argument because it really is not.
It isn't about that. No. And it's what? So we're living in 84, Orwell's 1984, free speech no longer exists in America. Well, it isn't about America.
Well, it's not about America. It's not about free speech. It's not about it's not about the suppression of free speech. It's about, in part at least, the part that's about speech is about using language in a way that doesn't mean what it's intended to mean as propaganda.
Yeah.
Which is basically what Don Jr. is doing with this tweet itself.
Yes, exactly. So he's actually, he is being Big Brotherish.
Yeah, we're living in Orwell's 1984 based on what I'm about to say in this tweet.
Exactly.
The fact that I'm using doublespeak and propaganda to try and sway people's opinions is, is 1984-ish.
And alter history, is 1984-ish. If only, you know, which wouldn't be so bad if he actually meant to do that. Well, he would be because he's giving it away in the first sentence. But so it's still a work of fiction.
It also brings to mind that brilliant Madison Cawthorn tweet where he said, 1984 is a good fiction novel to read.
Yeah. It's like three sort of tautological statements in one go. Yeah. Fiction novel to read. Yeah. It's useless. It's absolutely useless as any kind of fire retardant device, but to read is brilliant.
To read, yes.
Yeah, it's great.
And now is the time, I think, for Marx British Politics Corner.
Well, the whole kind of literary prowess thing is sort of Boris Johnson's shtick. His entire rhetoric draws on the appeal to fiction, ostensibly. And so there's 2, 3, 4, even more probably, from the speech he gave to the 76th session of the General Assembly of the UN ahead of COP26, and which started today as we record. So he gave this speech on September 23rd, 2021, and this was part of it.
The way to fix the problem is through science and innovation, the breakthroughs and the investments that are made possible by capitalism and free markets. And it's through our Promethean faith in new green technology that we are cutting emissions in the UK. Coal will be gone altogether from our energy production by 2024. We've put in great forests of beautiful wind turbines on the drowned prairies of Doggerland between Britain and Holland in the North Sea. In fact, we produce so much offshore wind that I'm thinking of changing my name in honour of the god of the North Wind to Boreas Johnson. There you go. There's a shove in that classical allusion this time of night to see if you're paying attention, folks.
Every time I listened to, and found the contents of these, I just went, oh, for fuck's sake. Like, it's just, and there's this kind of, he's playing on his knowledge of all the, of, you know, the myth of Prometheus, who defied the gods by stealing fire and gave it to humanity in the form of technology. And so that's why he's kind of alluding to Prometheus about the technological or the use of technology, and then shoves in the Boreas thing. You know, if anybody knows about generating a lot of wind, then it's Boris. So actually they're changing the entire field to name it after him. Hmm. But he's kind of, and he, you can tell that he's trying to play in the same way that he plays in the House of Commons, from the Etonian oiks that normally laugh, you know, in a lackey yes men kind of way, and they don't. They just there are no spontaneous guffaws. So he jabs at the audience and tells them out loud that he's making a classical mythological allusion in case they missed it. and you think, okay. And then he also gets in his sort of strange, well, it's not fictional, it's true, but that, you know, there are the fields of Doggerland before the English Channel flooded. There were plains between us and the Netherlands, so that, you know, that's true. But why do it, you fucker? So in reporting on this very speech, Bloomberg described Boris as a Latin scholar, but he isn't. And a Guardian journalist, Charlotte Higgins, points out she did the same classics course at Balliol College, Oxford, studying Greek and Roman literature and philosophy. And she reports in the article that one of the tutors, ancient historian Oswin Murray, called Boris probably the worst scholar he'd never sent us, a buffoon and an idler. And Anthony Kenny, who was the master of Balliol in Johnson's day, reflected in a 2018 memoir, what had we done for Boris? Had we taught him truthfulness? No. Had we taught him wisdom? No. What had we taught? Was it only how to make witty and brilliant speeches? And there's a, you know, definite question mark there. Does he do witty and brilliant speeches? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I haven't heard one if he does.
No.
Maybe he does them quietly to himself.
Yeah. But they're all so packed with all these fictional allusions in order to show off his geeky Greeky show-offery. And so let's have a listen to this clip.
The poet Sophocles is often quoted, or often quoted by me anyway, as saying that there are many terrifying things in the world, but none is more terrifying than mankind. But if you look at the Greek, what Sophocles actually said was that man, polita deina kuden anthropou deinoteron pele, is what he said. Which is deinos, man is deinos. And terrifying isn't quite right as a translation for deinos. What Sophocles really means is that mankind is, humanity is awesome. We have an awesome power to change things, and to change things for the better, and an awesome power to save ourselves. And in the next 40 days, we have to choose, the world has to choose, what kind of awesome we're going to be.
So you think, well, what was the purpose?
What the fuck doing was that?
The illusion, it's not even undergraduate level, it's kind of high school level, declension of Greek verbs or Greek nouns. You just think, oh, maybe the translation could be this because it could be awesome. And you think, what?
But so he starts off by saying, I regularly misquote Sophocles.
Exactly, yeah. Yes, yeah. Well, often people quote, well, I often do, to my own ends. And you think, well, okay, so why are you making this fiction, this allusion to a poem that was written by Sophocles about man's awesome power, or, you know, frightening power? Why are you doing that? Is it to make the point? Couldn't you have just said, we've got a chance to be awesome, you know, in the next 40 days we're going to do the COP26. Now's our chance. Yeah. We have the power to bring things about for the good or for evil. We need to choose which one we're going to do, and we should choose good.
I would also...
He doesn't actually put a choice in there.
No.
And says, we've got to choose which awesome and we've got to be.
Yeah, he doesn't make it clear that they're definitely choosing good.
No.
But I would also say that this is a point where there is a hazard in quoting fiction, in that people... All the characters that say stuff in fiction aren't necessarily admirable, good, or knowledgeable, or any of those kinds of qualities that you would hope. And so people will often quote stuff from books or from plays, which they think makes a point that they're trying to make. But it either wasn't said in that way in the original, or it was said by a villain in the original, or, you know, you've got to be really careful when you're doing that to make sure that it's actually backed up in context, because people who don't know what you're talking about don't get anything new out of it, and people who do know what they're talking about realise you're a dick.
Yeah, exactly. And or you do what Boris just did, which is if the translation that you're using doesn't suit your purposes, you just change the translation. Yeah. So you give them the Greek, which is, you know, said in the most un-Greek accent. You know, okay, we probably know that maybe the ancient Greeks didn't speak quite like modern Greek, but it certainly doesn't sound like.
I want to hear Boris
old Etonian English
to a Greek accent without being horrendously offensive. That would be amazing.
He would, yeah, and he wouldn't be so bad. But he's descended from Turks, so the irony is not lost here. And the whole purpose of him doing these quotations or these allusions to fiction isn't for it to enhance what he's trying to say. It's actually just to convince you by distraction that he is smarter than he is, and along the way smarter than you are, so you don't question his authority on that subject, or indeed on any subject. But the Guardian journalist just says his version of the classics, like so much in his repertoire, is lazy, tired, and utterly irrelevant. And I looked into Balliol College, where he went and studied classics. And Balliol College's unofficial motto is effortless superiority, which actually hilariously sums up Boris. Well, he doesn't put any effort in at all and holds himself superior to everybody. And in 2019, students at Balliol College called on Oxford University to disavow Boris and remove all traces that he ever studied there.
I can understand wanting to distance yourself, but I disagree with rewriting history in that way. There should be statues to Boris so that we never forget.
Yeah, and there should be a little contextual notice.
You don't know what's happened in history.
You don't know what's happened. No. And it should be one that perpetually, a bit like Prometheus, the fate that befell Prometheus was that he ended up, because of the theft of fire from the gods, he ended up having to have his livers pecked out by various birds of prey every day, and then overnight it healed up and he had to have it again. So Boris's statue in Balliol College should be, it should be toppled every day and then re-erected overnight. And then it's just pulled down by the students every single day. Yeah, and streamed live to some platform or other. And also in 2020, the same historian, Oswin Murray, sent Johnson a formal renunciatio amicitiae, a renunciation of friendship. It's what Roman emperors sent to those that they wanted to get rid of. It was an invitation to exile or suicide. And in a similarly classics-aware dig at Boris, way back in the 9th of September 2019, Leo Varadkar, who was the former Taoiseach of Ireland, the Prime Minister of Ireland, he made a classical jibe at Johnson, referring to the Herculean task to negotiate free trade agreements with the member countries of the EU and the US, now that the UK was moving out of the EU and thereby trying to reconcile the Northern Ireland Peace Accord with the withdrawal agreement vis-a-vis the hard border with Europe. And this is what he said.
It's going to be very tough. We'll have to deal with issues like tariffs, fishing rights, product standards, state aid, and it will then have to be ratified by 31 parliaments. Prime Minister, negotiating FTAs with the EU and the US and securing their ratification in less than 3 years, I think is going to be a Herculean task for you. But we do want to be your friend and your ally, your Athena, in doing so. And I think the manner in which you leave the European Union will determine whether that's possible.
Well, we know the manner in which they left, and it hasn't been possible. And you can tell how much Boris is interested in what Leo is saying, because only at the point where he says we'll be your Athena, who's Hercules' half sister, does he kind of perk up and chuckle and kind of go, ha-ha, you know, that kind of vibe. But yes, I understand that's a classical illusion. The only thing I can kind of tune into, because I will steal that. And so anyway, Athena's half Athena, Hercules' half-sister, actually helped him help Hercules complete 3 of the 12 tasks.
Yeah, she doesn't get any of the credit for that,
prevented
does she?
Him from dying. No.
You barely hear about her, the work she did.
Yeah, flocks Typical of birds, stopping him patriarchy. Killing other people. All that, yeah. Exactly. And thus prevented him dying in the process
I would
of
say
doing them, which was the plan all along.
That much as I'm enjoying all of the mythological allusions, I would say that this one in particular is more just of an analogy rather than
a fallacy.
In this, I don't feel like the Varadkar is using this, using anything fictional to back up an argument he's making or a claim he's making.
Yeah,
he's just saying, you know, this is something we're going to do, and it'll be like you're Hercules and we're Athena. Whereas with the Prometheus thing, he is claiming that if you read that and then look at us, that shows that we can do this because I think that one possibly less of a fallacy.
Right. So all right then. Well, so let's go back to the speech by Boris. So not content with destroying any affection we may hold for Greek literature, he now taints popular culture for us as well. So in the same speech, he shows just how up to the minute he is with climate thinking, not by alluding to Greta Thunberg or the work of Insulation Britain or Extinction Rebellion, who bring the immediacy of the issue to the world's attention, but by saying this.
And when Kermit the Frog sang, "It's not easy being green." You remember that one? I want you to know that he was wrong. He was wrong. It is easy. It's not only easy, it's lucrative, and it's right to be green. He was also unnecessarily rude to Miss Piggy, I thought, Kermit the Frog. But it is easy to be green. We have the technology, as we used to say when I was a kid.
There we go. Yes. So and those silences. Yeah,
that's the
deafening.
He keeps trying to like. Have you heard this? Have you heard about this, Kermit the Frog?
Yeah.
Do you remember? I mean, it's only a like 40-year-old reference.
Exactly. Yeah. And he also flings in a reference to the $6 Million Man.
Uh-huh.
You know. Yeah. And actually, it's quite handy because there's an English colloquialism, which is what a fucking muppet that he is, because in a room full of adults, that's the best he can come up with. And the fact that his obliviousness to the stone, he is completely oblivious to the deafening silences with which it's received. There's more proof that he is not in any way advanced beyond how he was as a friendless, chubby, scruffy child who's likely to have a tantrum in the supermarket if you don't pay attention to his little dance performance in the sugar frosting aisle, and is equally likely to dissolve in tears and hide in the fridge if you confront him directly about his utter lack of knowledge and complete inappropriateness for any role he thinks he's performing. So kind of alluding to Kermit, of all things, when you're talking about the possible destruction of humanity by its own hands, is not a good illusion, really, is it? Because it does, well, certainly in English colloquial usage, bring forth the idea, well, you're just being a muppet.
Yeah.
And then he kind of...
Get away from Kermit. Kermit wasn't... You know, he's suggesting in a way that Kermit was like
anti-environment.
Because he was saying it's not easy. It is easy.
It's not easy.
I'm right about this. He's wrong about it. He's taking it completely out of context for a cheap laugh you didn't get.
Yes. In a room full of adults that you have no right to be there. And he sneaks in. It was not only is it good, it's right, and it's lucrative. You can make money at it. So it's completely right. So not only is Kermit wrong for being an anti-environmentalist, he's also wrong for being an anti-capitalist. You know.
There is fiction in the space between the lines on your pages of memories. Write it down, but it doesn't mean You're not just telling stories. There is fiction in the space between you and everybody. Give us all what we need. Give us one more sad, solid story. But in the fiction of the space between, sometimes there's a wild fallacy. Sometimes a wild fallacy. Sometimes a wild fallacy.
Tracy Chapman there with Telling Stories. Very appropriate for an appeal to fiction.
So in the Fallacy in the Wild, we like to talk about the fallacy of the week from a non-political perspective. And our first example this week comes from Clerks. This is not the 1994 film, but the deservedly short-lived 2001 animated series. It was fucking awful.
Who greenlit that?
Starring almost all of the original cast, to be fair.
Oh, okay. They just say, we'll want to do a sequel. Yeah, no problem. A sequel, great. Because the first one, brilliant, box office, went down as like a cult comedy classic. Yeah, a sequel. Then they went, but we want to do it as an animated TV series. And I go, what?
I mean, to be fair, they tried to revive it several times in various different formats. So, and Kevin Smith, even though this was an animated series, Kevin Smith still played Silent Bob. So... Anyway, in this scene, Dante and Randall are talking about a local pet shop that's just opened.
Wow, a new pet store. Want to go check out the monkey?
I guess we should, if we're going to kill it.
What? Kill a monkey? Are you mad?
Man, didn't you see Outbreak? One monkey almost wiped out an entire town and Kevin Spacey with the deadly Motaba virus.
That was a movie. This is real life.
You said the same thing about Jaws when we were kids.
Because you refused to sit on the toilet.
Sharks swim in water. There's water in the toilet. I rest my case.
Fair enough, yeah. But, just because you saw a film where a monkey had a virus doesn't mean you should kill all monkeys. I mean, I feel like that should go without saying.
And Kevin Spacey. Yeah. Don't need to explain it. I love it because, you were the same about Jaws. That's because there was water in the toilet. Sharks swimming water. Ergo. Uh-huh. So
this thing is a common trope in films where someone says, this is real life. This isn't a movie in a movie. In fact, we're recording this on Halloween and I have a tradition ever since university. Every Halloween I watch a horror movie.
Yeah.
And today I went out to the cinema and watched Scream because it's the 25th anniversary of Scream this year.
Wow.
So they put it back in the cinemas. And Scream is packed with this kind of thing where Jamie Kennedy is talking about, what happens in horror films. And then someone will say, but this is real life. It's very full of this kind of stuff. So our second example is from an episode of Be Reasonable, Michael Marshall's fantastic podcast, which if you haven't listened to all of, you should immediately go and do that after listening to this.
Go and do that.
Yeah. So this is from episode 74, in which Marsh talked to a guy called Christopher Anatra, who is a believer in the Mandela effect being a proof of people injecting negative situations into our timeline in ways that some people can notice as things that are different from what they remember and some people can't. And that's one of his explanations for the Mandela effect, which is where people notice things that they've just remembered wrong, basically. And they think, that's proof of alternate timelines. But he backs up his argument by saying this.
And if you ever watch the show The Man in the High Castle, you begin to see some of those concepts as well about what the Nazis are trying to do with conquering things. And I think there's some soft disclosure in there.
I see. And by soft disclosure, could you just explain what you mean by soft disclosure, actually?
Yeah, so with soft disclosure, you'll see concepts... in movies, for example, in books and so forth, that explain the way the world works, but kind of like they make it like sci-fi fantasy, like this can't actually be true. Or if you watch any of the Marvel movies, a lot of them are talking about timelines and picking the right timelines.
So his argument is that whoever is doing this,
they
are also showing us that they're doing it by making films and TV shows about alternative timelines.
Yeah.
And he goes on to talk about Loki and the time variants and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And this is a weirdly common thing that comes up in conspiracy theories. And one of the things that in the last episode that we did of our Patreon-only kind of sister podcast, the QAnon Book Club from QAnon The Great Awakening, this came up with our most recent chapter that we did, where the writer was talking about the proof that you see in films of what is going on with people sacrificing children. It said that then they have the nerve to blast it in your face, as they do in movies like The Dark Crystal, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, Monsters, Inc., brackets, The Fear Meter, etc., showing how to gather adrenochrome that gives them some form of high and youthful looks. Now, I've seen Monsters, Inc. a few times. I don't remember them talking about adrenochrome.
No.
I don't think that came up.
No. And Dark Crystal?
Dark Crystal. I mean, there is a kind of kidnap plot in that of abducting children, and
so then why isn't Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Well, exactly.
I mean,
what I would say is why isn't like Sleepless in Seattle in there? And what the point is, if films are telling you what's really going on in the world, if you assume that the fiction is true, what about all the other films?
Yeah, like Shrek.
Yeah. What's so is your argument that only the films that conform to what you think is secretly going on behind the scenes, if you really twist the nature of the film, those ones are real and secret messages from the Illuminati, who just can't help telling everyone their secret plans by making multi-million dollar movies about it? And what are the other films for? Are they just to give cover for the fact that those films exist?
That's all it is. It's the whole thing. The whole edifice of Hollywood is to make that go, right, okay, we've got to tell these people about what we're actually doing, but in a kind of undercover kind of way. And then, but won't they notice that? Yeah, no, what we'll do, we'll make...
We'll make 800 films a year. And two or three of them, we'll put some kind of child abduction plot in there so that the really, you know, awake people will know what's going on.
Yeah.
For some
reason. The
rest
of them will just, it's like The Matrix.
Yeah. But and then some Illuminati person pipes up and says, hey, how about if we just didn't tell people what we're doing? And the others are like, no, fuck off, Steve.
The whole of the movie industry would collapse. Don't be stupid. Yeah. Got vested interest now. That's right. And who are we telling these people when 98% of them will just think it's a story featuring Indiana Jones? Yeah. You see, it's the 2%. Those are the people that we really need to tell. He said, but they're against us. They want to kill us. They want to do away with us. So why are we bothering to tell them? That was where my plan falls to the ground.
It's bizarre. And so our final example in this section comes from a story that we again touched on briefly when it originally came out, which was that certain anti-vaxxers, are making the argument on social media that I Am Legend, the Will Smith film, they say that the thing that turned people into zombies wasn't a virus, it was a vaccine. And therefore, you shouldn't get vaccinated. Because a film...
Because sharks swim in water.
Washing
my toilet.
And that was the thing. They were actively using this fictional film as a backup proof to their argument that vaccines are dangerous. Because in a film, it turned people into zombies. It didn't, even in the film. That's not the point. It wasn't a vaccination. It was a modified measles virus that was a cure for cancer. So it wasn't a vaccination. And the writer of the film, Akiva Goldsman, ended up tweeting, for God's sake, I made this up. So. Not a good way to make an argument.
No.
Right, before we move on to fake news this week, just time to talk about our Patreon. Not just to convince you to become patrons, which of course you should. I mean, that goes without saying.
Well, yeah, it goes without saying.
Yeah. But because we are getting to the end of our QAnon book club. We are almost at the very end of the book, and we need something else to do after we finished it, really. So we'd like some ideas.
I think we need a good rest after reading that book.
So maybe. But yeah, we'll need either another book or maybe you'd like to hear us talk about films or like Mike Lindell's documentaries about how he can definitely prove that the election was rigged, or I don't know. You give us ideas of things you would like to hear in that patron extra episode, and we'll probably do one of them. If you are a patron, you can do that in our patron feed or on Facebook. If you aren't a patron, you can do it on Facebook or you can become a patron. And now would be a great time to do that, because not only would you get the entire run-through of the Fear, Trump in the White House, Bob Woodward book, and within weeks, the entire QAnon book club.
Yeah.
Also breakdowns of various films like Wonder Woman 84 and Ghosts Can't Do It and things like that. But also, we are just dollars away from hitting our next patron goal, which is basically where the patrons pick a topic, be it flat earth, anti-vaccination, gun control, whatever, and we will look at all of the logical fallacies on both sides of that issue.
Yeah, all of them.
We will do some proper research.
Yeah. I'm not looking forward to that in the slightest. It's just going to be mind-blowing. Yeah.
If that's something you'd like to hear, then push us over the edge into the next patron goal by becoming a patron for just even a couple of dollars a month is enough to get you all of that good stuff.
Yeah, do that. And as a sidebar, I was scrolling through Netflix trying to find a film to watch with the anti-vaxxer in my life. And they said, oh, Wonder Woman 84. And I went, no, we are not.
Have you tried I Am Legend?
No, not going near that. Because.
So, patreon.com/ftrump.
So we're gonna play
fake news, folks. I love the game. It's a great game.
I understand the game as well as anybody. As well as anybody.
Yes, it's time for Fake News, the game where I read out three Trump quotes, two of which are real and one I made up, and Mark has to figure out which one is fake news.
I'm kind of buoyed up by my recent run of successes. And as Rocky Balboa once said, it ain't about how hard you hit, it's about how hard you get hit and keep moving forward. That's how winning is done.
Yeah.
So I'm quite prepared to be punched in the face this week.
You are having an immense run of success. I need to fight back. So sticking with the movie theme. The theme this week is times when Trump has talked about films, and you'll be shocked to learn he isn't always great at quoting them.
Right. No, really? Right. Nor working out the context within which he should be referring to them. Yeah. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Statement number one.
Yep.
This is when he was talking about Obama basically kind of telling people what he was going to do in Iraq militarily. He said, why does he have to talk about it? You know the movies, shoot first, talk later, right? Shoot first, you talk about it later. But why does he have to do it? The Good, the Bad and the Ugly, I like that movie, right? Don't we like it? Remember the Bad, boom, from the bathtub, shoot first. That guy was doing too much talking up there, right? Shoot first, talk later.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah.
Statement number two. This is in response to Parasite winning the Best Film Oscar. He said, what the hell were they thinking, giving them Best Movie of the Year? Best Movie? Bring back some of the great old movies like Citizen Kane. That's a great movie. Or Gone with the Wind. Can't we get Gone with the Wind back? Remember that? With the Rebels? Frankly, Scarlett, I don't give a damn. Whatever happened to movies like that? They can't make them today.
Okay, that's because
So statement number three, this is about Adam Schiff's characterization of Trump's phone call with the president of Ukraine. Mm-hmm. He said, he made up a story. It was total fiction. And then at the end, he said, don't call me, I'll call you. That's a mob statement. Very famous statement in numerous movies, one in particular. That's a mob statement. Don't call me, I'll call you. He said that I said that. He said that I said 8 times quid pro quo. Well, there were no times quid pro quo, nothing.
Okay. Okay. Right. Well, see that caveat about him misquoting it, because the bam boom from the bathtub, that was the ugly. That was Eli Wallach. Because he goes into the disused town to take a bath, and then somebody comes in after him, not Lee Van Cleef, and it's the ugly that shoots him. Okay. What the hell think of the Citizen Kane? How does he know Citizen Kane is a great movie? He just knows it's a great movie. He's never seen it. That's a great movie. Gone with the Wind. So that was about slavery. Yeah, that's a good one. Yeah. Okay. The mob statement, don't call me, I'll call you. Okay, so... okay, I think then that now I've changed my gut feel because I know you just laid a trap. I think that the one you made up is number one.
Okay, so of the other two, which are you more convinced by?
I think more convinced by number two, the one about Citizen Kane.
Okay.
Yeah.
And number two.
Yeah.
Is.
Yeah.
Fake News.
Oh, man, I knew that. I knew that as soon as you said that. Oh, no. That's really very good then. Bloody hell.
Yeah.
The Citizen Kane. I should have gone with that.
It's the Frankly Scarlet I Don't Give a Damn. I found on a list of popularly misquoted movies and thought, who the fuck thinks it's that? Who says, people say, Luke, I'm your father, or we're going to need a bigger boat instead of the actual line. But everyone knows it's Frankly, my dear. No one says Frankly Scarlet. That's not a popularly misquoted film. Anyway.
Citizen Kane that kind of threw
it. Yeah, he does apparently really like Citizen Kane, but completely misreads it, because obviously he thinks Charles Foster Kane is the hero. and identifies it with him, this politician who claims that if he loses, it's all rigged against him, and Errol Morris, the documentarian, did an interview with him where he talked about Citizen Kane, and they talked about the scene where Kane is kind of, his business is growing and he's losing contact with his wife. He's like dismissing his relationship for success.
Yeah.
And their breakfast table gets kind of longer and they get further and further apart. And Errol Morris asks Trump, like, what advice he would have for Charles Foster Kane.
Right.
And Trump said, get yourself a different woman. Like a better
wife.
Like, that's the problem. Is the wife wasn't doing her job properly.
Yeah. I thought you were going to say, send out for breakfast.
No, he's completely missed the point of Citizen Kane. Yeah,
absolutely. My God. Nor does he get the fact that it's a dig at William Randolph Hearst.
No, I think
he thinks he's a real person. He thinks Kane is great. Should have been elected. Yeah, it was stolen. Wow. Oh, right. So I'm going to have to go back and watch it again from the viewpoint that it's Trump now.
Yeah.
Wow.
In fact, there's a lot of parallels. It's quite weird.
Yeah. Oh, my God. What if he's used that as his playbook? No.
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Which means that number one is real.
Oh, no.
Where he claimed that the bad shot from the bathtub.
Why does he have to talk about it? You know the movies, shoot first, talk later, right? 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 Shoot first, you talk about it later. But why does he have to do it? The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly. I like that movie, right? Do we like it? Remember? The Bad. Boom. From the bathtub. Shoot first. The guy was doing too much talking up there, right? Shoot first, talk later.
So first of all, you're right that it's the ugly, Eli Wallach. And the phrase is shoot first, ask questions later.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the phrase.
Yeah.
But that's not even the quote from the film.
No.
The film, Eli Wallach, after he shoots the guy, says, if you have to shoot, shoot, don't talk.
Yeah.
Which is not the same thing at all.
No. And actually, shoot first, talk about it later. Well, why would you? because the guy's dead. You're not going to talk to him, are you? Yeah, but it's that. Yes, quite.
And yeah, shoot first, ask questions later isn't generally held up as good advice. That's no. It's like
no. And he's kind of rallying the crowd, and they're all going, "Yeah, we love that movie." Blah blah. And then he goes, "Remember the bad boom for the bathtub." And you can hear people going,
"Was it him? Was it Lee Van Cleef?
It was Eli Wallach. Lee Van Cleef? He's got a hat. Eli Wallach was in the bath with the thing around his neck. Yeah. And then they go, oh, yeah, shoot first. And you can just think, oh, yeah, well, there you go. That's good advice, isn't it? Just shoot first. Don't ask questions. Shoot first. Yeah. That's why a lot of people died under his watch, because he was going, yeah, it's fine. Yeah.
Don't talk.
These people are
don't
peacefully
think.
Protesting on my way to the church. Let's just shoot them first and then ask questions afterwards. Oh, Jesus Christ. Oh, no. And it also means
number
the
three.
Other one is real as well.
Real.
Oh, no. No.
He made up a story. It was total fiction. And then at the end, he said, "Don't call me, I'll call you." That's a mob statement. Very famous statement in numerous movies, one in particular. That's a mob statement. "Don't call me, I'll call you." He said that I said that. He said that I said 8 times quid pro quo. Well, there were no times quid pro quo, nothing.
Is it a mob statement? Or is it something that casting directors say?
Exactly, yeah. Don't call me, we'll call you. Why is it a mob statement?
I mean, I haven't seen all mob films. And please, audience, if you know what film he's talking about, if that is from a film, tell us. Because it's not The Godfather, it's not Goodfellas, it's not... You know, it's not like the famous ones.
No, not one in particular. No, anyone in particular.
Numerous movies, though, apparently. It's a mob statement that isn't very famous in numerous movies.
Numerous movies, none of which we've seen. Well, if his go-to ones are, you know, earlier films that he misquotes, he's going to go, yeah, I'm sure I've seen a mob story. They've said that it's a mob statement, like you bloody know. You know, no, you don't. You don't. And then he does that usual thing of generalizing, and then people kind of think, yeah, you're just making up. And then he'll pretend to have a specific example.
Yeah, I'm not going to tell you what
just
it is.
Say, no, he'll just say one in particular.
Yeah.
You do know. You're not just making up the general stuff. Yeah.
I'm surprised he didn't add. You know the one I mean.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. You know the one. Yeah.
I don't even need to say it. It's so famous. Yeah.
It's so famous. Staring you in the face. Don't call me, I'll call you. No, it's not. It's like, we'll make you an offer you can't refuse.
Yeah,
That's a mob statement, isn't it?
Or, be a nice house you got here, be ashamed if something happened to it. That kind of thing.
Yes, exactly, yeah. Nice police station you've got here, Inspector. Yeah. Shame if something nasty happened to it.
So, unfortunately, your epic run has come to an end.
Oh, wow, there you go, yeah.
And that means that you are now back to 50%.
There you go. See, Rocky Balboa... He was right. It's about getting hit in the face.
Got to get back up again.
Yeah.
And it's time for the part of the show that this week, at least, is called Helena Hutchins is Not a Logical Fallacy. Because, unfortunately, on October 21st, there was a tragic shooting on a film set in Santa Fe, New Mexico, in which a cinematographer, Helena Hutchins, was shot and killed. Joel Souza, the director, was injured in the same incident, and it was Alec Baldwin who was holding the gun that discharged at the time. And because it was Alec Baldwin, and Alec Baldwin did mean impressions of Trump for 4 years, the right wing has decided that he's a murderer, basically, because this happened. And so we thought we would talk about this because... Although there is a lot of speculation at the moment and the investigation is ongoing, there's a lot we don't know. There is some stuff that has come out kind of publicly. There's affidavits that have been released and there's some information that has been released. And a lot of people on the right are using this as a point against gun activist and liberal actor Alec Baldwin. I have worked on film sets where we've used prop and blank firing guns.
Right.
I've used guns before. I've got some firearms experience, and I've had firearm safety training. I don't know what your experience is in that kind of area. Ever been on a set with guns?
Yeah, but not on films, on stage.
Right.
But the and you just use completely.
Yeah, stage blanks are quite different.
Yeah. Yeah.
Where there does it's normally just a noise really with a stage blank.
Exactly.
With film prop guns which need to fire, there's various different types of guns on film that need to fire. The ones that are most commonly used are either completely rubber guns that don't have any ability to fire or do anything or cycle or anything, but they look very realistic. There are kind of airsoft guns, which fire little kind of BBs that, obviously don't make a noise or a muzzle flash or anything like that. Yeah. There are guns with dummy rounds, which look like real bullets, but don't have the ability to fire. They are completely empty.
Right.
They look realistic for loading into a gun.
Right.
And then there are blanks, which are cartridges which are loaded with usually actually more gunpowder than a regular bullet would contain. Mm. Because that's what makes the muzzle flash that you kind of see on camera, and it makes a loud noise. But they don't have a round in. They don't have any lead in the cylinder.
They
are crimped. They often have wadding, which can be cardboard or some other material. And they are dangerous to fire at close range.
Right. Yeah, because it's still going to come out at a great speed.
Yeah.
Yes. And if it's a balled up piece of cardboard, that's going to hurt.
And because sometimes these weapons can still be dangerous, even if they are loaded with blanks, there are protocols that are used on film sets to make sure that they are used safely.
Yeah.
So basically, we're going to talk about some of the things that people have been saying about this situation and questions that people have been asking about the situation, and we can kind of answer some of the questions and explain what should be the case usually. Generally speaking, in fact, in my experience in all cases, and if it's a film with any kind of budget whatsoever, and usually on low to no budget films as well, if there's any kind of firearm to be used at all, there will be a firearms expert, an armourer on set who has complete control over those firearms. It is their job to look after them, to make sure they don't kind of get handed around and stuff, and they usually have them in a locked box all the way up to the point where they're going to be used for filming or rehearsal, and then they will gather them from the actors at the end of the scene and lock them up again, and they take responsibility for that.
Right, yeah.
However, there's another line of defence on film sets, which is the first AD, the first assistant director. They are the producer's eyes on set, and they have responsibility for safety as a whole on film sets.
Right.
So whether it's, you know, a zip wire that needs to be rigged or electrical cables that need to be kind of taped down to the floor so people don't trip over them, safety briefings that need to be held, or health and safety kind of forms that need to be filmed in, that's the first AD's job.
Right, yeah. So they're the person that's ultimately, in this case, they would be in charge of the armourer's activities, or responsible for.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
So yeah, so the armourer will work with the first AD. They will often also work with the props master if the props master has any kind of influence on that area. Sometimes the props master will just do non-firearm related props, and then the armourer will do anything that involves firearms. However, one thing that isn't part of that safety protocol is the actor.
Right.
Because they don't usually have any expertise. And more importantly, they have lots of other things to think about.
Yeah.
When an actor is preparing for a scene or getting ready to rehearse or getting ready to shoot, or they are thinking about their costume and their lines and the camera angles and all kinds of different things. And so it is not left to the actor in any way. It is not a part of the process for the actor to take any responsibility for making sure that a gun is not loaded.
Yeah.
The armourer is completely responsible for that, and the first AD is responsible for making sure it happens. making sure the armourer does their job, essentially, before the gun gets to the actor. So all,
that's all the actor's expecting, just to be handed something that's perfectly safe.
They'll be handed a gun. They'll often be shown. They would often, in fact, usually probably be shown that the gun is unloaded if it is supposed to be an unloaded gun. It isn't always the case that the gun they're handed is unloaded. It isn't loaded with live rounds, but it may have blanks or it may have dummy rounds. And that isn't quite as simple as looking at it and showing that there's nothing in the magazine, in the chambers, if it's a revolver, and nothing down the barrel. So it's not quite as straightforward as just showing the actor that it's not loaded and the actor saying, yeah, that's not loaded. Things happened on this set which shouldn't have happened, it seems. I mean, obviously, because there was an accident.
Yeah.
There are things we still don't know, and there are rumours that have been put about, and there are things that have been kind of, you know, witnesses have made statements on the record. Other people who were in the room have made statements on their own, like, for example, Serge Svetnoy, the gaffer, the head electrician on set, has put out a Facebook post on his own Facebook saying his opinion of what happened. So this isn't something that's being filtered through the media, but it doesn't mean it's necessarily completely unbiased. He was a friend of Helena Hutchins. But his opinion is that it's the responsibility of the armourer, and that there were kind of perhaps corners cut in hiring a relatively young and inexperienced armourer for this film.
Because I think it was only her second film.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, the armourer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, is 24, and she had previously worked on one Nicolas Cage film. She is quoted in interviews around the time of her first film as saying, or after the first film, as saying she wasn't really sure she was kind of up to the job, but it all seemed to go okay, basically.
Yeah.
She's the daughter, incidentally, of Thel Reed, who was a kind of a legendary gunsmith. And I mean, he holds various records for shooting and like quick draw competitions and things like that. So he has been in the business for years and has trained most of the actors you see with guns on screen to use guns.
Wow.
So I'm kind of surprised that she doesn't have more experience.
Or isn't more confident about it, or knowledgeable about what to do.
Yeah.
Was there not reports from the previous film that things weren't, the people didn't feel comfortable? Well, Nicolas Cage was in the previous film she worked on, and he didn't like the way that she...
Well, this is where it becomes a bit difficult. As I mentioned, there's Serge Svetnoy has put out a statement himself. He's head electrician. Reed Russell, the cameraman, Dave Halls, the first AD, has been quoted in like legal affidavits and search warrants and things like that. Information from Alec Baldwin and from Joel Souza, the director, have also been put on kind of the official record. A lot of the other stuff that has been talked about has been from unnamed sources.
Right.
Which makes it difficult to know how reliable that is, because we don't know where they're coming from or what that information really is. And it leads to things like a story that went out where someone tweeted a Deadline article where they'd inserted a paragraph which claimed that Alec Baldwin was playing around with the gun. He was... asked for another take by the director and said, how, you know, another take, how about I just fucking shoot the both of you, and then shot them.
Whoa.
That did not actually happen. Yeah. It wasn't in the Deadline article. The Deadline said, no, that we didn't write that. That it bears no relation to what we've learned. The original 911 call, which is on the record and you can listen to it, says that they were rehearsing when this happened. So that definitely didn't happen. It wasn't that he was like frustrated at having more takes or whatever. What seems to have happened from the 911 call, from the affidavits and the information we know from people who are named and on set, is that the armourer, Hannah Gutierrez-Reed, had three guns that were to be used that day in a locked container. After lunch, she took them out of the container and put them on a kind of tray, a cart that was outside.
Yeah.
And the first AD, Dave Halls, took one of the guns and handed it to Alec Baldwin. He has said he didn't check. Dave Halls has said he didn't check the gun.
Right.
He believed it to be what's called a cold gun, no ability to shoot, essentially.
Right, yeah.
And he said as much to Alec Baldwin. He said cold gun. In fact, it's claimed by multiple people that he yelled cold gun. As
right.
Some sets, people set, do that. Other sets, people don't.
Yeah.
I mean, it wasn't a scene where they were going to be shooting blanks. It was a scene where there was going to be a close-up of the gun pointed at the camera or near the camera. So you would see in the chambers, because it's an old Western, so it's a revolver, you would see in the chambers that there were bullets in the chambers.
Yeah.
So it was filled with dummy rounds, which are just a casing with a kind of rubber tip and is often filled with a BB so that you can kind of shake it and you can hear the rattle so you know it's not a real bullet.
Right.
It also doesn't have a primer.
Right.
So it's different from a live round, but not to the extent that an actor would be expected to open up the gun, look at it and know the difference necessarily.
Yeah, yeah.
Also, again, not the actor's job at all to do that.
Yeah, yeah.
And on many sets, if the actor started messing with the gun, that would be cause for the armourer to take the gun back off
take them, it off them.
Recertify it as safe. And, you know, it's basically, it's not only not the actor's job to look at it, it's like against the rules for them to do it.
Yeah.
All they're allowed to do is what they're directed to do by the firearm expert.
Yeah, because it's just as much a prop as a glass of whiskey that isn't whiskey.
Yeah.
You know, you just got to drink it, and you drink it, whether it's cold tea or whiskey.
Yeah.
You have to, you know, you're expecting that it isn't going to be whiskey. You're going to drink cold tea and pretend it's whiskey.
Yeah.
Yeah.
People have asked questions of, you know, and these are people who, fair enough, are coming from a perspective of you never point a gun at anyone and you always check, you always assume a gun is loaded and you always check whether it's loaded. Those are firearm safety rules that everyone learns the minute they are first given a firearm.
Yeah.
But they are not necessarily people who have even thought about the concept of using firearms on a film.
Yeah.
The idea of not pointing at anyone is a luxury often in films. It's wherever it's possible, just like fight scenes, you don't actually punch someone. If possible, with angles, you can aim a gun away from a person and kind of make it look like it's aimed at them.
Yeah.
But when, as in many films, the gun is aimed at the camera or just off camera, there is inevitably going to be a cameraman / cinematographer / director there.
Yeah.
If there are going to be blanks, that's often done with a long lens. So that means like a telephoto lens. So the camera is a long way away.
Yeah.
Because blanks, for the most part, cinematic blanks beyond about 20 feet, it's completely safe. There's no way anything bad can happen to you if you're that far away. So sometimes it'll just be filmed from further away, and that's how they keep it safe. Sometimes if they need to be closer to the camera, there'll be a bulletproof Perspex screen or something like that to keep people behind the camera from being in the line of fire.
Right.
But it's not fair to say you can make all films and get all the shots that people want to get without anyone ever pointing a gun at another person on cinema.
Yeah.
It's just not practical.
Yeah.
It's also not reasonable to say he should have checked it wasn't loaded, because again, it's first of all not his job. Secondly, it was supposed to appear loaded, for the shot,
and the fact that the AD gave it to him, it's a cold gun,
yes,
yeah.
So the argument he should have checked it wasn't loaded and shouldn't have pointed at anyone. In an ideal world, that's true, but making films is slightly different. And it's the same. Yeah. I've seen it said that if there was a scene where Alec Baldwin was on a zip line and the zip line broke and he fell off and landed on someone and killed them.
Yeah.
It's the guy who rigged the zip line who is the person who did something wrong there. You wouldn't expect the actor to make sure that he could check the zip line was safe. Because it should be safe. You should be able to trust people to do that. Anytime an actor has ever parachuted for a film, that actor did not load their parachute.
Yes, exactly.
An expert in parachute packing did it.
Yeah, yes, exactly. Because they're actors. They're not experts in zip line technology or parachute packing. Yeah.
Anyway, in this case, somehow a live round, an actual bullet, was in the gun.
Yeah.
And during rehearsal, when Alec Baldwin was practicing drawing the gun from his holster and aiming it at the camera, we don't actually even know if he pulled the trigger yet. Mm-hmm. It's possible it discharged somehow in some other way, but it's also possible he pulled the trigger. But again, not expecting anything to happen, he pulled the trigger and the shot went into Helena Hutchins' stomach slash chest area, again not entirely sure where, and threw into Joel Souza's shoulder, who was standing behind her. I've laid out why I don't think Baldwin is responsible as an actor. That doesn't necessarily mean he doesn't have any responsibility, because he's also a producer on this film,
right?
But then we get into very difficult situations, because producer means very different things. You can be a producer who literally is just getting a credit and some back-end money on a film, right? And that's all you are as a producer. You know, you're they sometimes give producer credits to actors so that they don't have to pay them as much up front, and it's a bit of a vanity thing. You can be a producer who is completely in charge of hiring everyone on set and raises the money for the film and you know, runs the production kind of alongside the director. I think that the Coen brothers kind of act as director producer both on their films typically, and they kind of do both roles. So
if that was his role, then he'd be responsible for hiring the first AD and the armourer. And so there would be some latent responsibility for the people that are working.
It's been reported by Deadline that the producer, the on-set producer with kind of day-to-day responsibility and responsibility for hiring ultimately the armourer and the first AD as well, was a guy called Ryan Donald Smith, who's just one of the other producers. He hired an Atlanta-based production services company called Third Shift Media. They then hired the armourer and the AD.
Right. Yep.
So it doesn't look like Alec Baldwin was in that line of decision making. But that doesn't mean he doesn't have any responsibility in that aspect of it. There have been reports, again these are less well sourced, more speculative, that some union crew members, a union crew camera crew, walked off the set because of safety concerns earlier that day, and they continued filming with a non-union camera crew.
Right.
That doesn't necessarily make it less safe, and we don't know what that union crew's safety concerns were. They may not have been related to firearms at all. And some have suggested that, as not only a producer but obviously the biggest star on the film, if he kind of had sympathy for their concerns, he should have essentially shut down production until they could address those concerns. Even if he wasn't kind of the one ultimately in charge, he still, as the kind of star, has that power in a way, which is arguably true, but certainly doesn't rise to the level of legal responsibility to do that.
No.
In the early 80s, there were a couple of deaths on a John Landis film, Twilight Zone the movie. Vic Morrow was killed when a helicopter crashed in a scene, and a couple of child actors also were killed. John Landis was prosecuted for, I think, involuntary manslaughter as director and producer, and the production team, the other producers on that film, were prosecuted. Ultimately, they were acquitted. But there is absolutely scope for there to be a prosecution brought on the basis of that Alec Baldwin was one of the producers, if there is any evidence that in part led to this happening. But in my opinion, there is a great deal more likelihood that there will be prosecutions brought against the armourer and the first AD, who were the ones who actually were being paid specifically to make sure something like this didn't happen.
Yeah.
There is...
And were the ones that gave them the gun.
There is absolutely no explanation yet as to how there were any live rounds at all on set. Yeah. There shouldn't have been at any point.
Yeah.
There was no reason for that to happen.
And I'm kind of surprised that, you know, Donald Trump Jr. is heading the zeroing in of the fact that, you know, guns don't kill people, Alec Baldwin kills people, which is a T-shirt that you can get via
Donald Trump Jr.'s website.
Yeah. And you kind of think, well, actually, they're kind of missing a trick, that there's all of these this other scope for conspiracy theories that, you know, normally conspiracy theorists would be filling in the space.
Yeah, but because he's, you know, the bad guy, as far as that, right. That's the thing, because he's an anti-gun liberal who attacked Donald Trump.
Yeah.
Therefore, open season. And these are the same people who are going after him. Don Jr., Charlie Kirk, Dana Loesch, Dinesh D'Souza. These are the same people who have repeatedly and vociferously defended Kyle Rittenhouse, the guy who actually crossed state lines with a gun that he was too young to own and shot people.
Yeah, yeah.
And they are like, he's a hero. Ashley Babbitt, the woman who was trying to enter the Capitol and was shot, is a martyr. Alec Baldwin is a murderer.
Yeah.
It's bizarre. But there is this, you know, this sense from people who know about guns that these rules that you have to follow not on a movie set are, you know, absolutely black and white. And if he knew anything about guns, if he wasn't a, you know, commie pinko liberal actor and had ever done a gun safety course, which undoubtedly he has, given that he's used guns in multiple movies, that this wouldn't have happened. There's very little evidence for that. And there was a study in the New England Journal of Medicine in 2018 where researchers looked at, they hypothesized that during the annual 3-day National Rifle Association meeting that is had, that if firearms accidents weren't necessarily primarily caused by inexperienced firearms users, but were just generally caused by more firearms use, then firearms injuries, accidental injuries, would go down over that period during those 3 days. And they looked at an extended period, multiple years, and they found that indeed they did go down, and they went down statistically significantly nationwide. In their eye, it's a correlation, but it's a correlation that is statistically significant, repeatable, and bore out the hypothesis they had before they started looking at the data.
Yeah.
And it happens every year. And in the state where the conference is taking place each year, it goes down by about half. It goes down from about 1.9 to about 0.8 injuries per 100,000 gun owners, which is a small absolute figure, but a significant total figure if you factor in all the gun owners.
Yeah.
And they hypothesize that this is because lots of people who would be shooting generally instead go to this conference for that weekend. And in fact, people who run, you know, gun clubs or gun ranges or, you know, hunting places where you can go hunting and stuff like that, they are shutting down for that weekend so they can go to the conference. So there isn't this.
Wow. So there are fewer guns being used.
Yeah, but specifically by NRA members.
Yeah,
during
yeah.
that period, and there is this consequent drop of accidental discharges that cause injuries. So, based on that, which seems, you know, it seems likely that it isn't just people who don't know what they're doing who have accidents with guns.
Yeah, yeah, because it goes up when the people who know what they're doing are firing guns.
Yeah.
The number of accidents caused by accidental or, you know, non-supervised or non-professional.
People not deliberately shooting each other.
Even by people who are deliberate shooters
and
in other contexts.
During those periods, they also looked at firearm-related crimes, and they stay absolutely constant during those periods. So firearm-related crimes don't go down, but accidental discharges do go down. So
wow. So calling him out for not being a professional by the professional body that is responsible for the increase in accidental discharges when they're not in a conference. Yeah, doesn't kind of hold water. And it is, I'm somewhat disappointed with the conspiracy theory hive mind, because there are so many opportunities for, you know, disgruntled cameramen going off set and maybe guns being left out and accessible over lunch.
There have also been claims. There have been people who have doctored tweets to suggest that Helena Hutchins tweeted that she had evidence against Hillary.
Whoa!
In the days before she was killed. That her next film was, that the next project she was going to be working on is a film about paedophiles in Hollywood.
Of course, yeah. And that's why she's been taken out.
Even people saying that she was kind of the leader of the union that were complaining.
Yeah.
And as the producer on the film, that's why Alec Baldwin shot her. So he didn't have to basically negotiate with the union or something.
Yeah, because it's a much
yeah, it's much easier. Yeah,
yeah, it's a much more reasonable. Yeah, there's no strings attached to doing that, are there?
But one thing that's happening in Hollywood, which doesn't happen when, you know, there are mass shootings and all that kind of stuff, is they are looking at this and taking it seriously and thinking, okay, what changes do we need to make?
Yeah.
Because while blank firing guns are the best way to get something that looks good on camera, they're not the only way.
Yeah.
And lots of film companies are now talking about just completely banning anything that fires a projectile now. The Rookie, the ABC TV show, which is about police, they have now said they will only be using rubber guns and airsoft guns. They will not fire blanks.
And they'll just put it all in post.
If they need to put muzzle flashes on, they'll do it in post. They'll just deal with it. If it makes it harder, if it makes it more expensive, whatever. It's about safety. Yeah, and I've seen this from other organisations and companies, production companies as well, saying, it is harder but doable to do it in post.
Yeah,
and
so that's kind of a global filmmaking world reaction to that within days.
Yeah,
which countless bloody school shootings or whatever made no difference whatsoever.
And by no means do I think it means that that will be the end of blank firing guns on film sets at all, because they are still absolutely the best and easiest way to get that effect.
Yeah.
And they are also overwhelmingly safe. There have been, I think, 4 or 5 injuries in now, 130 years of making film.
Yeah.
Yeah. Based on this problem. And a few of those were in the kind of the early days. So it is terrible that this has happened, but it is not an indictment of Alec Baldwin or of the film industry in general being kind of, you know, not safe or lackluster. Things that should have happened on this set and procedures that should have been followed weren't followed. That will be investigated and things will happen because of it, I suspect.
Mm.
And, you know, we'll probably get more information in the coming days about what actually did happen and didn't happen that should have.
And finally, some things we really don't have time to talk about.
Given the lackluster way in which the January 6th Select Committee seems to be following up and enforcing subpoenas, you might be forgiven for thinking they're not doing much. But a Rolling Stone article last week revealed what some of the people involved in planning the protests have been telling the committee. They've detailed dozens of planning meetings in the weeks running up to January 6th, where they met with exactly the kinds of congresspeople you would expect, including Madison Cawthorn, Marjorie Taylor Greene, Mo Brooks, Lauren Boebert, and Paul Gosar. You know, all the ones who've desperately been downplaying the seriousness of the insurrection ever since. You might remember Gosar as such a piece of shit that 6 of his own siblings campaigned against his election, or maybe you just remember that he's a dentist and therefore an expert on body language.
Oh, yeah.
2 of the protest organisers report that Gosar offered them blanket pardons on multiple occasions to encourage the protest objecting to the certification of the election. One said, "Our impression was that it was a done deal, that he'd spoken to the president about it in the Oval, in a meeting about pardons, and that our names came up." Both sources claim the planning was restricted to the protest at the White House Ellipse and not the events at the Capitol, which kind of makes you wonder what those blanket pardons were supposed to be for.
For blankets that they were wearing on their heads. Given Trump's relationship with the truth, let's face it, it was to a large degree why he was ultimately banned from broadcasting his version of it on social media. It's somewhat ironic that his new social media platform is called Truth Social, yes, in capital letters, announced on Wednesday and due to launch in 2022. It's part of Trump's grand gamble to create a new media empire to compete with Netflix and Disney Plus for streaming TV and even go after Amazon and Google with new cloud hosting services designed to be non-cancellable. Natch, within hours it was hacked, kind of. A beta version of it was discovered and quickly populated with appropriated faux accounts under the names of Donald Trump, Donald J. Trump, Mike Pence, and even Ron Watkins. Former Republican National Committee official and conservative journalist and Trump's new personal spokesperson, Elizabeth Harrington, excitedly tweeted how she was looking forward to posting her first truth on the network, where you can also read truth, others' truths, onto other even others' truth feeds, despite the beta testing site being quickly filled with pig poop balls memes. Further truths about the network are hidden in the fine print. Whilst being a platform that encourages an open, free and honest global conversation without discriminating against political ideology, Rule 17 states that you're not allowed to harass, annoy, intimidate or threaten anyone who is an employee of the site or one of its agents. Rule 23, that you can't disparage, tarnish or otherwise harm, in our opinion, us and or the site. And Rule 20, which says you can't tweet or truth using excessive capital letters, one of Trump's favourite shouty tactics. On further digging, hackers revealed that the whole entity is run by CEO of China Yungong Holdings Limited as part of Trump Media and Technology Group, TMTG, which also describes TMTG Plus, a streaming service for non-woke entertainment, claiming a massive market opportunity to build a non-cancellable global community and galvanise a conservative media universe. Turns out the whole thing runs off Mastodon, a free open source piece of software that allows people to set up their own social network, which requires anyone who modifies it to make their own source code publicly available and to acknowledge where they got it from. Staunch truther, Trump hasn't, of course, and now Mastodon's founder, Eugene Roshko, is considering legal action. But far be it from us to point out the failings of the doomed enterprise, because that's being mean. And we'll get banned.
Oh, I'm going to get so banned.
Yeah.
I was really hoping to be banned by now from Frank Speech, Mike Lindell's network.
Yeah.
But still they haven't got it working yet. So
yeah. Brilliant.
Twitter announced last week that according to internal data, their algorithm does tend to amplify right-wing politicians and news sources more than left-wing ones. And I'm sorry to say that it's kind of my fault. Well, not just me, but everyone who just can't help themselves from taking the piss out of Republicans. Researchers at NYU's Center for Social Media and Politics looked at how frequently various politicians get ratioed. For the non-Twitterers, that means when their tweets get way more replies than retweets, suggesting that people are arguing rather than agreeing with them. Ranking all members of Congress in order, the most ratioed are supposed Democrats, Joe Manchin and Kyrsten Sinema, but the next 18 in the list are all Republicans. And it seems like all this interaction is causing the GOP's message, along with all our pithy, well-thought-out and hilarious responses, to be spread farther and wider. Sorry, not sorry.
You're in with the MAGA in crowd. I am. Oh, who's your doctor? You look so well. Why, it's Dr. Stella Emanuel. Oh, yeah, she's great. I can agree the fuck out of everything she says. Masks are useless. She's told us she's effectively used hydroxychloroquine on her patients. Yeah, all makes sense. What's her background before COVID? Oh, proper qualifications. Endometriosis. Oh, yeah. Caused by people dreaming about having sex with demons. Uh-huh. Alien DNA is being used in medical treatments. Of course. Scientists are planning to use vaccines to stop people being religious. Mm-hmm. And now she's revealed that the devil has filled the world with clones and they will assassinate those who refuse to take the mark. The vaccine, you mean? Yeah, for sure, the mark of the beast, because the Moderna vaccine contains luciferase, which is the name of the beast. What, you mean the same harmless enzyme luciferase that the active ingredient in fireflies that isn't actually in Moderna? No, everything about this vaccine is 666. Yeah, yeah, the number of the beast. Yeah, that's right. Isn't she amazing? She's out of her bleeding mind. Hey, where are you going? Look, with medics like her, how are we going to bring down Fauci? No, come back. We need you. Hey, we're going to make it all great again. Again.
Yeah. Clones of who?
Oh, no.
Who is she? Like herself? Clones of the devil?
It's filled the world with clones.
Why can't the devil just assassinate the people himself? Is he too busy?
Why have you got to have a clone?
So fucking weird.
They're all like Agent Smith, that's what it is. Uh-huh. And you'd go, because they'd just go, well, how do you know they're a clone? Well, they all look alike. Yeah, okay, but who do they look alike?
You know how sometimes you're working on a group project at work or in college, and there's one member of the group that wants to do things a bit differently and kind of makes it weird? Well, four parents have banded together to sue the Bucks County, Pennsylvania school district in an attempt to fight the district's mask mandate. Three of the parents talk about their family's philosophical objections to mask wearing and cite problems their children have faced, including difficulty breathing, depression, anxiety and migraines, all of which they attribute to the mask requirement. The fourth parent, Shannon Harris, echoes some of her co-litigants' claims and adds, "The Harris family identify as Christian and believe that it is against God's will to wear masks because wearing masks interferes with their religious duty to spread the word of God and forces them to participate in a satanic ritual." She doesn't go into detail on which satanic ritual her kids feel compelled to perform purely due to the small piece of fabric on their face, but the lawsuit was already total bullshit before they added the batshit, so it's not really going to make much difference.
It goes from, okay, interferes with their religious duty. To go, oh, yeah, how's it?
Yeah, because you can't talk through it.
Spread the word of God, And then it escalates to, and subsequently forces them to participate in a center.
Yeah, I presume what happens is they just kept, because they're wearing masks, they get caught up in a crowd of Satanists who are all off to perform a ritual.
Yeah.
And like, you know, just
they don't recognize them.
It would be rude not to do it too.
You can't kind of stick your hand up and they just go, well, yeah, sure.
Oh, I'm not supposed to be here.
Yeah. What masks are they wearing? KKK hoods? What?
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Or things with like horns on the side or something. Yeah. Democrat Terry McAuliffe is renewing his bid to be governor of Virginia, having been that from 2014 to 18. Slavering Trump acolyte Republican Glenn Youngkin is up against him. Glenn pretty much needs all the help he can get if he's going to prevent McAuliffe getting in an election viewed as a bellwether for the Democrats' party's chances of hanging on to their congressional majorities in the 2022 midterms. So, who's weighed in to back Youngkin but Rudy Giuliani? Fresh from his astonishing impression of the Queen of England lying about something, he's posted a video using a face filter of Abe Lincoln to lie about the old debunked claim made against McAuliffe when he was chairman of the DNC during the Clinton administration. In another, if not the same, well, several execrable accents, he exhorts Virginia to vote against the man who dishonoured our past by selling my bedroom hundreds and hundreds of times to scoundrels in a pay-for-play scheme. In my time, we had a name for men who sold bedrooms for one night. In your time, the name is Terry McAuliffe. End the Clinton sleaze once and for all. Patricia Arquette is quick to point out, you couldn't help but go all Adolf at the end, right? And Frank Lesser wrote, "Congrats, Rudy. This is the second worst thing a bad actor did to Lincoln." Needless to say, Mr. Youngkin, with friends like Rudy, I wouldn't want to hang about the Ford's Theatre either.
And incidentally, if you're listening to this in Virginia on the day that it comes out, today is the day you need to go and vote. In case one piece of North American science denying parental protest news wasn't enough for you this week, we bring you the anti-vaccination parents of Guelph, Ontario, a dozen of whom plan to disrupt a school board meeting to protest about the district's vaccination policy regarding school sports. They arrived in the parking lot of the school board's office at 6:30 last Tuesday and discovered that the meeting, which was being held over Zoom, had already been going on for half an hour, having started as scheduled at 6. The protesters ended up just holding signs up outside the window, which said things like, "The jab won't make a better player," which suggests they really missed the point of the vaccinations, before everybody left having only wasted their own time.
Here in the UK, we've had a new budget announcement. All were agog at what it would hold. Would the rich get taxed and the poor get helped? Nope. Chancellor Rishi Sunak made a lot of announcements which involved Corbyn-sized socialist allocations of money to health, education and the police. So shocked were we that nobody noticed he was simply using the end of COVID as cover to reintroduce funding for the very sectors that had been cut by more than he was giving them over the last decade and a half by the same government. The voters, however, will love it, because human psychology being what it is, we can't remember that we used to be able to afford to put the heating up to 25 degrees this time last year, but now we're just so grateful that because of Rishi, we can just put the heating up to 20 from the freezing measly 15 we were able to last week. Bloody Labour would be spending billions then taxing the rich to claw it back, not like the fiscally responsible Tories spending billions and taxing middle-income earners till their pips squeak again. Hot on the heels of a removal of the fuel duty being applied to passengers taking internal flights, the entire cabinet flew to Glasgow for the COP26 environmental summit, where Boris said, "We must all act together now or it all fails," which basically gives him the out for not following up on any of his promises, whilst blaming those countries in the global south who are suffering the effects of the fortune-making industrialisation that they were never a part of, for not doing their bit by not shutting up about support and remuneration. Greta, of course, went by train, but has not been invited to speak. After all, what does she know of contemporary environmental commentators like Kermit the Frog? She's too damn young and naive.
So that's all the bad arguments and faulty reasoning we have time for this week. You'll find the show notes at fallacioustrump.com. And if you hear Trump say something stupid and want to ask if it's a fallacy, our contact details are on the contact page.
If you think we've used fallacy ourselves, let us know. And if you've had a good time, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can support the show at patreon.com/ftrump. Just like our straw man level patrons Kaz Tui, Steve Bickle, Schmutz, Mark Reiki and Amber R. Buchanan, and our true Scotsman level patrons Max Beaver and our top patron Lauren. Thanks very much for patronising us so beautifully. We really do appreciate your support.
And you can connect with those awesome people as well as us and other listeners in the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/fallacioustrump.
All music is by The Outbursts and was used with permission. So until next time on Fallacious Trump, we'll leave the last word to the Donald.
That's right. Go home to mommy. Bye. Bye.
Glenn pretty much needs all the help he can get if he's going to prevent McAuliffe getting in an election viewed as bellwether for the Democrat Party's chances of for the Democratic Party's chances of hanging on to their congressional. I'll come again. Amongst our weaponry are such diverse elements as fear, supplies, and almost nice red uniforms. Oh!
Say goodbye to your credit card rewards. Greedy corporate mega stores, led by Walmart and Target, are pushing for a law in Congress to take away your hard-earned cash back and travel points to line their pockets. The Durbin-Marshall credit card bill would enact harmful credit card routing mandates that would end credit card rewards as we know it. If you love your credit card rewards, tell your lawmakers, hands off my rewards. Tell them to oppose the Durbin-Marshall credit card bill.
A new year, time for new growth. Grow your education and skills with Herzing University. Our online behavioral health programs fit your schedule and time. From an 8-month diploma program in health and human services to a 36-month bachelor's in psychology. Grow your behavioral health career with us wherever you are in your education. Your future starts now at Herzing University. Visit us online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109. Online at herzing.edu or text health to 85109.